The following is a conversation with Ray Heffer, field CISO for the Americas at Veeam Software. Before joining Veeam, Ray built a career over 2 decades specializing in cybersecurity, infrastructure, and cloud services. His journey includes pivotal roles at VMware, where he honed his expertise in virtualization and cloud computing. This background equipped him with a unique blend of technical skills and strategic insights, making him a respected voice in the cybersecurity community. This is the Sound of Tech to Come, a Veeam podcast. Well, Ray, you've been at Veeam for just over a month now, I think. So firstly, give us a little bit of a background about your journey to becoming the field CISO for the Americas at Veeam.
Yeah, I'll try and keep it short. It's funny, security for me really started in the mid-90s. We didn't even call it cybersecurity back then. You know, this was the heyday of the Matrix coming out in 1999 and all that cool stuff. But, you know, I remember as a Unix admin, security wasn't even top of mind. And then I moved into a public sector organization where I got hit by the I Love You virus. And I was an IT manager at the time. And this was a small organization. We didn't have a CISO or security manager. You know, no. I wore all those hats. But these were the days where I had a firewall and antivirus on all the workstations and some web and email filtering. And it was interesting that cybersecurity incident, that virus, I dealt with by adding an email filter. But, you know, this is where it all started for me. And it was even in those early days, I learned the importance of things like user education. You know, again, talking about the heyday, you might remember this. There was a video that went viral, and viral in those days meant email, right? It wasn't social media. And there was this video of this guy sat in a cubicle on this keyboard. He gets angry and he smashes his keyboard across his monitor.
I still see it today.
You still see it, the very 90s thing. But people used to just click stuff. And he said something else then. They used to just click on whatever they received in the email. But look where we are today. It's crazy. But it's funny because it was after that I moved to an internet service provider and I started getting involved in pen testing.
Okay.
And talking about the Matrix, you know, I was using tools like Nmap. And those tools, you know, of the 90s, early 2000s, are still used today. And yeah, you know, pen testing, I had a mentor. And he introduced me to that. And I really, really got the bug. Ironically, I joined a government regulator. So doing a lot around ISO 27001 and ITIL, which is a big part of what I focus on now. And ironically, it was that role that took me away and ultimately led to me joining VMware and took me away from security for a little bit. I joined VMware in 2011, moved to the US in 2016, and here I am, just to speed through that.
Speed it up. I had flashbacks, actually, when you were talking about those early days of security and around that timing. You know, I think my first security product as such was ISA Server 2000.
Oh, yeah.
And I was in control of that server, right? And it was so raw back in the day, like the stuff that, you know, you could see and get away with. And it was crazy, man. We were looking at desktops, we were looking at email, we were looking at when MSN Messenger first came out, you could basically see people's conversation.
Wow, yeah. Brings back memories.
Yeah, you could see people's messages in clear text. Sometimes I didn't want to see what people were talking about, but that's another story. But it's just crazy to think that in those early days, the level of security was so raw. People knew that you still had security, it was a thing, but it's so different today where now the industry is so established. It's the thing that everyone talks about in the last 3 to 4 to 5 years, specifically around ransomware and cybersecurity and being ready, zero trust, which is in your sort of wheelhouse. But maybe I do want to go back to VMware because I think it's important to understand. Obviously, we're here, you're new at Veeam. People probably don't know much about the role. We'll talk about the role at Veeam shortly, but maybe take us through that journey in VMware from being a virtualization admin and then getting back into the security focus part of the role. And your last title at VMware was field CISO as well, right?
Yeah, it was the same role. It's a good point because, you know, I joined VMware in 2011. That was professional services. And, you know, I was involved in some very interesting projects. Security was still a big part of that. You know, you couldn't deliver an architectural design without having security, you know, baked into that. But I'll tell you something, actually. It was around 2016, soon after moving to the US from the UK, that I was working with, I was in the cloud provider program. So cloud providers, I'm not talking about the big public cloud providers, but the smaller ones that are using VMware technology to deliver their services. And in our team, we had cloud strategists. There was Marwan, JP, who else? And Patrick, if they're listening.
I know these people. I mean, that was my world, right? I mean, that's how you and okay. I kind of know each other as well, to a certain extent, through that platform, the cloud provider program and what I was doing in there. But that's why I knew about you anyway. So yeah, there you go. It's a small world at the end of the day.
It is. And to be honest, you know, I was an architect. You know, I think I was on the path to becoming a principal. I got that in 2018. But working with these guys, this was, six, seven, 8 years ago now. I was looking at them thinking, wow, you know, I love what they're doing, because the VCDX, actually, I should mention that I got the VCDX at VMware, which is the VMware Certified Design Expert. But that approach is applied to an architect. And it really is looking at the business. Mm. What are the business outcomes? Let's gather the requirements for the business and then ultimately deliver an architectural design based on those requirements. But looking at the strategists, I was thinking they're just so business outcome focused. This is where I want to go. But I didn't put that together with the security piece until, you know, a few years later. So they were like my catalyst, that spark in the early days. But I wanted to get back to security. I did go to AWS. I came back to VMware. I was in a DevSecOps role for a few years on the Tanzu team. But ultimately, you know, accumulated to the role I'm in today, and you know, very thankful to be part of that journey with Veeam now.
Yeah, because as we've talked about before, and people listening would know that, this is a new frontier for Veeam. And the messaging obviously shifted a little bit towards the end of last year when we looked at, you know, radical resilience and really, you know, releasing our first 12-point run release, or the 12.1 release that we released was the first one that had very specific security-focused features and functionalities, right? And that was the top-line messaging. So, you know, this role obviously has been born out of that. And there's no doubt that in our space, you know, within the broader ecosystem, security plays a massive part. Data protection is one component of that. And I think, you know, you're pretty much in that. So what do you see the field CISO role being within Veeam in the context of a data protection company?
Yeah, that's an open question there, because within Veeam and outside of Veeam, I think people see it as different roles. Outside of Veeam, I'm getting so many messages on LinkedIn thinking I'm the CISO for Veeam, and I'm not. You know, CISO is focusing on security for the company. A field CISO, I would actually, you know, label this as a cybersecurity strategist. You know, going back to the cloud strategist I said I worked with, you know, back in the day, this is a cybersecurity strategist role. So unlike field CTO, I'm not focused on going deep into a product, but more focused on the executive audience within our customers. And ultimately, you know, that is the CISO. And if you look at what they need to do to be successful, you know, many CISOs will have to present to a board of directors, and you just can't go to a board and start talking about, you know, these are the features of 12.1. We've got inline malware detection and Yara rules and all this great stuff. I've got to translate that. So I think that's a key essence of my role, is translating that into metrics and KPIs, things they're measured on, help them be successful so they can take that to the board and also communicate that to the team.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, the fact that you're not the CISO as such, right? And I had Gil Vega on the show in October for Cybersecurity Month. And yeah, what he does is crazy. It was an intriguing, actually one of my most favorite podcasts that I've ever done across the board, right? And talking with him getting all the insights from him about his journey towards being the CISO of Veeam, what he does in the company, right? And you probably don't want that sort of pressure just at this point, you know, like there's tons of pressure in that particular role. But I think to that point, what I'm going to say is that you made a really good point about going in and talking to these CISOs in companies to basically help them strategize about what they can do best to help their company survive an attack or be resilient before an attack happens, and how you then recover from attack after that. Because my working theory, and I think I told Gil this back in October, was that it seems to me like unless you're a seasoned CISO who's gone through the ranks like Gil has over the years and kind of earned your stripes, a lot of the CISOs that we're seeing being elevated into this role are not traditionally strong in that area, or their level of experience isn't that strong, because it is a fairly new position as such in terms of the what it gets. So is that the challenge that you have actually going into these companies at VMware? And obviously you've been doing this for a month now at Vane. What do you think that's a challenge, is educating these people who might not be ready for this?
Well, it's interesting. I would have said yes, even just a few months ago. And a recent experience I had, which was I went in very daunted, a bit nervous. I'd just come back from Canada. Huge event by CyberX. It's a Phil CISO forum. There's around 600 CISOs in the room that I'm doing a presentation to as a fireside chat. And that's scary stuff, right? And I went in with this idea in my head that, these are all going to be way more experienced than me. And, why would they listen to me? After that session and talking with a number of them, I was actually quite surprised how many CISOs were new into the role. And I actually saw some of this at VMware. And the number one question I got, and I've had this before, was, I mentioned NIST, cybersecurity framework, and I can talk more about that in a moment, zero trust. You pick, there's hundreds of frameworks out there. But the question was, how do we get started? Where do we get started? They find that quite overwhelming. So we can go in, we can always assume that there's all these CISOs out there like Gil who have got a tremendous amount of experience, but actually out there with our customers, that's not always the case.
Yeah, and I think that was my point. So I think you're confirming my theory in that, it's such a new position and a new role, and something that's kind of coveted from the outside, and then a board or a business or an executive team will say, hey, we need a CISO, let's get one, without really understanding what that means. And then they'll pull someone in without understanding what it actually needs and how they need to facilitate that role. So
I was going to say, what I also see is they all promote the security engineer, that's been with the company a long time. The problem there is they technically they're great, but they don't have the business focus.
The business side of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to actually early on going to say a joke about a CTO and a CISO walk in a room, which also is tied into a Englishman and Australian as well, but I'll leave that alone. But it's an interesting sort of demarcation, and we've had some good conversations. I know you've been working with the other field CTOs and the regional CTOs in Veeam to work out, the engagement that we do have, and it's very complementary in a way. In fact, it is complementary, right? So I'm really kind of interested in how, we've got these roles. We've got one in EMEA, we've got you in Americas, and then we've got one, I don't think it's been filled yet. It might have been filled last week, I'm not sure, but I still think it's not been filled in APJ. And how effectively, we can work together to actually tag team to tell the whole story at that business outcome level, because I think that's the biggest thing that, we can do now, is go into these events. We can go have these fireside chats. We can go talk to the companies at these levels and have the different level of conversation and still be successful holistically. And I think that's part of this strategy of getting these roles in place. Is that kind of the way that you see it as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason I think we need those regional field CISO roles, I cover the Americas. And, if I was to make my own job title up, I'd say I'm an Americas cybersecurity strategist.
I like that.
We have one for APJ, we have one for Europe. And the reason for that is frameworks and regulations vary so much. When I speak to my counterpart in EMEA, Andre, he's talking about what's happening in Europe. And I should know, I come from the UK, but I've been in the US long enough that he's teaching me stuff about NIS, not NIST, but NIS. There's different frameworks, there's different regulations. So we've got that focus. But on the other side of it, there's three things I typically talk about with a CISO. The first one I'll actually focus on here is the strategic integration of data protection and incident response. And you're asking about what we help with. With that one, what we are seeing, when I say we've got the Veeam Data Protection Trends Report out, 2024, new one, and other trends analysis reports highlight this as well, that there's this gap between IT operations and the security teams and incident response. And going back to the security teams, a well-established and well-run, well-oiled, whatever you want to call it, SOC team, they're going to have incident response playbooks. They're going to be doing tabletop exercises where they run through a ransomware event. And if they've really got it nailed, they won't be doing that in isolation. They'll be bringing in HR and finance and other parts of the organization. But that's the problem. We don't always see that. So IT operations are like the afterthought.
Yeah.
When it happens, I mean, again, it's when, not if. if they haven't run through those scenarios, and you know, you might see behind me, I'm a bit of a nerd. I like fantasy fiction, so I always liken this to Dungeons and Dragons and
nice.
Yeah, those scenarios. But it is just that if you have fun with it, use it as a collaborative effort in your organization, relationship building internally in your organization, and also bring in third-party vendors as well. I think that really strengthens your whole overall security posture. So that was number one. Yeah, number two I mentioned is GRC, governance, risk management, compliance. Mastering that and these security frameworks, it goes back to that question I often get asked is, where do we get started? My answer is always just pick a framework. Yeah, NIST, CSF, it's only 700 pages. No, I joke, it's 52 pages. And if you cut off the table of contents and the title page and everything, you're down to like 40-something pages of stuff to read. It really isn't heavy. You can get through that in an evening. And I'd say just pick a framework and stick with it. And then the third one, which is the third part of the role I have here, is this proactive ransomware defense recovery readiness. And that's probably where I will then start crossing over and handing off into a field CTO, because then, you know, that's where I talk about all the capabilities we have with early threat detection, inline malware detection. We have 4 Eyes security. That always makes me smile, because if you remember the movie War Games.
I do love it.
80s. I love this stuff. Right at the beginning, there was the nuclear missile launch.
And it had to have
2 keys. Yeah. And every time I think of that, I think of that.
You know
movie.
What? That's exactly what I think about when I think of 4 Eyes. We should have actually called it 2K. It would have fit a lot better, I reckon.
We'll call it War Games. Eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. The War Games thing. Yeah. But that was a cool little feature. And actually, to be fair, we've been adding little bits and features and functionalities like that even before 12.1. I mean, there was little things like MFA, which seems like table stakes type of features, but we just didn't have them before. You know, basically auto log off for the console, yeah. Other bits and pieces like that. So these little security features and functionalities that we've added along the way have just continued to strengthen the product, which is a very strong, you know, backup and recovery product, and got all the other bells and whistles. And so now we're just tagging on all these little important checkboxes, which in this day and age, especially we need if we're going to be successful out there doing business and protecting people's livelihoods through data protection.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, you know, we've obviously ransomware is going to be the number one topic, you know, whether you like it or not. It is what's driving all of this. It's happening. And in fact, where I was originally from in the UK, you know, coastal town near Brighton, there was I don't want to mention names, but there was a ransomware attack on a local utilities company just last week.
Right.
And it's interesting to look at that, because you can look at the sort of the typical template for, oh, ransomware attack. You know, you pay the ransom. There's things like double extortion, by the way, where this actually happened with them. They paid the ransom, I believe. They got a decryption key to decrypt the data. You know, and one, is your data going to be in a good state afterwards is the question. But even then, they leak your intellectual property. And this is why I'm actually so passionate about this. They're leaking personally identifiable information, PII. Yeah. So it's the IP and the PII. Which is why I do this in the first place. I'm a huge privacy guy, but we can talk about that another time. But
just to put some flavor on that, Ray's got a brilliant podcast, which is, it's kind of fresh, isn't it? It's the Lockdown podcast. I'll link to it in the notes, but it's great.
Oh, thank you.
I really like the way that you structured it. And yeah, I mean, if I was coming into it without knowing you, I'd go a very tinfoil hat type of guy, right? Like he's really big on his security, right? And identity protection. But
I do some crazy stuff, but
it is. But I think it's great, and I think it's well worth a listen as well, because I think more of us, if we're even like 10% as much as what you talk about, I think we'd all be better off, right?
Yeah, and even that's hard. Yeah, you know, in the US, why, for example, why is there not a default credit freeze on everybody? Because with the credit agencies, I don't know what it's like in Australia, but you know, we've got the main credit reporting agencies. You can go to that and get all sorts of information on people. And typically it ends up, you know, with junk mail and things in the post. If you do a credit freeze, it blocks a lot of that. But it's also used by identity thieves. So,
which is a big way where people get in. I mean, I know that on Facebook alone, I've been hit about 4 times in the last couple of months by an account that appears to be my auntie in Malta. And every time I know it's not her, because I know now that she, somehow her account and her profile has been targeted multiple times. But my mum nearly got done by that, because it was like, it's her sister. You know, it was basically one of those ones where you go, hey, sis, I've met this guy. He's saying that if we put 1,000 euros into this account, we're going to get 10,000 euros back, you know? And my mum goes, well, this is awesome. I'm going to do it. And it's a good thing that she was at home when she was talking about that, because I just looked at the conversation. I looked at the tone and the style of the writing. I said, that's not your sister. And then I said to her, ask her a question about something that only you would know when you grew up. Like, tell her about, ask her about what street you grew up in and that sort of stuff. And, you know, straight away it was like, oh, sis, you know, why are you asking me that? And it's like, get rid of that right away. You know what I mean?
It's so scary. So, yeah. So, Anton, you're an AI guy.
I do like to dabble lately. Yes, I am dabbling lately.
So I've got a question for you then. There was an incident here in the US where the congressman had a call supposedly from his son, and it was a deep fake voice clone of his son. And it, long story short, he had to pay some money to get his son out of jail. Wasn't really there. You know, he went very public with this. Well, what are your thoughts there? Because this is scary stuff. What you're describing, it's there, scary. The next evolution of that.
It's scary. Like, I think there was an incident that happened even a few weeks ago where a financial controller of a company, what it was was the financial controller of a certain company was on a Zoom meeting, but it wasn't him. It was a deep fake of him. And he was telling all of his accountants to basically pay these debitors or these creditors now and just do it now. And even though they were asking, like, should we really do this? He was like, yep, get it done. It was all deep faked. And they ended up losing some multiple of millions of dollars worth of company funds through it, right? And they had no idea that it was a deep fake. So you're right. It's super scary. And I mean, OpenAI only in the last week have released a new technology, or haven't released it, but announced a new technology where you can generate up to a minute of video based on a prompt. And
I've seen that. It's amazing.
It's crazy, right, where we're at. But just think about that in the wrong hands. I mean, just having what we had last year with the generative AI capabilities to code and to make your code better, and even for someone who wasn't a good coder to create something that could encrypt something like an S3 bucket with these. Now, if we've got the capability to deepfake with a sentence, that's even more scary. So we're entering some really scary times when it comes to that. But I think to that point, it's just part of the natural evolution of technology and where we're at. We have to embrace it, but we have to embrace it from all sides. And that means businesses need to also embrace it from all sides, which also means embracing a data protection strategy, a cybersecurity strategy, to make sure that when you are hit, you can recover from it, right? So I think people like you and I and companies like Veeam, all this technology is coming out, it's even more important to leverage us, basically.
Absolutely. I'm a huge believer in that. You know, this, take what's used on the offensive and use it for defense. You know, I do this in my privacy world. There's something called open source intelligence, or OSINT, which is, you know, more of an investigative thing, but I use defensive OSINT. You know, what information can be found there again on me? Then I'll use those techniques to block it. But going back to the AI thing, it's funny that, I think, is it called Sora? OpenAI Sora?
Yeah, so, I think it's something like that. I was trying to remember what it was, yeah.
It's funny, when I looked at that the other day, it says they're opening up just for red teamers, so security folks, and movie directors. And I thought, well, my hobby is cinematography and I'm in security, so maybe I've got a chance of getting access. But it's AI does concern me. I just want to touch on ransomware again, because I took on a challenge the other night to write some ransomware using ChatGPT. And it took me one evening, and I have an encryptor and a decryptor and an HTTPS listener. I've actually got fully functional. Obviously, I'm not going to share it. It's not on my GitHub, so please don't go looking for it. But I just want to highlight that, you know, that would work. You have to manually execute it. It will encrypt everything on your machine. It sends the key over HTTPS to a listener. So it's very difficult to extract the key, you know, because it's not on disk, or it's never written to disk, and there's a decryptor. But when we're looking at what's actually going on out there, there's Lockbit, there's Conti, Black Baster, there's all these different groups. But what's actually happening is these are ransomware as a service providers. Lockbit 3.0, I had a look into this. To get access, you know, we often just dust this off. Oh, you know, script kiddies now can go to this ransomware as a service and off they go. They don't have to have any knowledge. You've got to deposit one Bitcoin, which is like $50,000 at the moment.
It is.
Just to get access. You also got to prove that, you know, that, again, reminds me of The Matrix, prove who you are. You know, you're a hacker. You know, show us what you've done. Show us your forum posts. Show us your breaches. there's a level of sort of entry and entry requirements to even get access to Lockbit. When you do, it's vastly different to what I created with ChatGPT. This is a SaaS service. There's a command and control. You know, there's support.
It's crazy.
It's an organization. Just
yeah. When I talk about people like that, yeah, it is illegal, but they're a business. They're an enterprise, and they're doing great business, right? They're thriving. I talked about this last year a little bit when I was doing some security roundtables in ANZ, talking around this topic, and people were amazed that these groups had help desks that would ring up and help you, right? And I think a lot of people are more educated now, maybe in the last 6 months, about that happening, especially at certain levels. But the majority of people, if you go and tell that story like you just did, they'll go, get out of here, man. That's crazy stuff. Like ransomware as a service, that's what it is. But to your point, the people that are getting access to that need to be some pretty malicious guys to start with, right? So you already know they're pretty bad guys if they're getting access to that.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. And, they've got criminal backgrounds. The ransomware as a service operators, they're getting like a 20% cut. They're making a fortune from this. But this is, I think, where we start crossing over the level of sophistication. It's far beyond what I can knock up with ChatGPT, even though I've got a functional ransomware, ethical simulation. I'm not going to obviously use it, but there's just far beyond that. And I think it opens up this, and I'm just thinking openly here, nation states have that level of sophistication. And this is what concerns me, things like Lockbit, Conti, they come from adversaries, Russia, Iran, North Korea. And I just think we're going to see more of that. And the other thing that concerns me is AI is very interactive at the moment. We ask it to do something, we get it back. When it starts to perform actions and we can say, hack this website or perform a ransomware and it does it for you, that's then really scary.
Yeah, I you know what? It's funny, without giving away what I'm working on for Vaemon, there's a little bit of that as well, like turning just a two-way conversation into something that's actionable and saying, hey, like, in a good way though, for good, get me the version of a server. Okay, it's server X. Go online and check if there's a recent update for it. Okay, there is. Now I want you to stop all backup jobs, take a backup of the config and patch it, patch the server. And in theory, that could work, right?
Mm.
So if you take that, which is really using AI for efficiency and kind of natural language way of interacting with platforms, that in a negative sense in bad people's hands, holy moly, it's scary to the next level. We could talk for hours on this particular subject in terms of the threat landscape that is out there today that's evolving more and more. But I think the good thing that you mentioned is that as one side evolves, so does the other. And I think that's where we come into play as a company. It's where Veeam works with our ecosystem partners, with our great security partners, to be able to offer a end-to-end solution to mitigate, protect, and then recover. I think that's what we've got to get to. Absolutely. Hey, I just want to finish with a couple of questions around, which is related to that actually. Veeam and a lot of backup companies have tried to or have pivoted to security as a messaging, first. And I think Veeam's still, pretty much at its core a backup and recovery company that talks about that, first and foremost. And obviously we're releasing more and more features to, help in that cybersecurity space, which is what you have to do. How have you found that coming into, from VMware in that world to the backup world as a security professional and trying to look at the interlock that's happening and the sort of blurring of the lines between data protection and security?
Yeah, it's interesting. As an outsider, in a way, I look at vendors and they're touting zero trust and these frameworks, and I look at it with skepticism. And I'm going to critique it. What I really love, what we are doing at Veeam, is not just taking that as this marketing ploy and all of our products are zero trust certified or whatever you want to put on there. What we're actually doing is it's actual capabilities, but it's almost like an extension of zero trust. So that there's I mentioned CISA. This is Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency in the US. I might have butchered the acronym, but CISA, they have a zero trust maturity model. And there's five pillars here. So it starts with the user, the device they're using, the application on that device, the network, and then data at the end. And often what we see with customers is they're on a zero trust journey, or this could apply to any other framework, but let's just take zero trust as an example. And they will get so far and stall, they hit a brick wall, because you know that if they've worked with a vendor, that early momentum stops. So by the time they get to data, you know, it stalls. But even the framework itself, it refers to NIST and other frameworks. But I think for us, we've got this amazing opportunity to really educate not just customers, but I'm talking about the cybersecurity industry, of the zero trust, that extension into recovery. Because you know, at the end of the day, it's going to happen. And if paying the ransom isn't going to get you the decryption key, and even if it does get you the key, if it gets you a clean restore, that's unlikely too, because typically you get this janky script and it doesn't work properly. Yeah. You've got to bring in other incident response companies to work with you. But if you've got an immutable backup that can't be touched, it goes back, you know, the CISO will know about this, the CIA triad, confidentiality, integrity, availability. If you've got a backup that's integral, it hasn't been touched, it's not been messed with, then you've just cut through all that other nonsense, because you can then restore. And ransomware groups, they are going to target backups. You know, that's absolutely. And that's another thing that this ransomware as a service does automatically. It's looking for backup targets. It's crazy.
Yeah, and who's the number one data protection company in the world? That's us. That's Veeam, and that's why we're getting targeted more and more. I think it's not a surprise that, you know, when competitors go, oh, well, Veeam's getting targeted quite well. No, of course, because we have the biggest numbers out there, right? So that's kind of the way that it works. I think that's actually interesting as well, because in the data protection report last year, I don't know the specific number, but I remember that, you know, you really want to get down to not paying the ransom and being able to recover your data in its entirety. I think that's the whole grail, right? So not paying the ransom and getting all of your data back. And for memory, the percentage of that people were able to have a combination of that was only about 10 to 20%. So Veeam's mission really in life is to make that 0%. Like everyone is basically getting then their data back through a validated recovery without paying the actual ransom as well. So that's where I have to be. Hey, quickly, zero trust as a sort of word, as a vibe, as a marketing thing, how are you looking to take that zero trust message and apply it to yourself when you talk to customers and partners and other CISOs in your role?
Yeah, so I think a number of things is education around it. You know, so often, and I hear this from other CISOs, I hear, oh, zero trust, it's just another form of least privilege. It's just another name for least privilege.
That's what I would have thought, actually, if I was talking about it as an uneducated individual, that's how I would basically describe
it. Yeah, and don't get me wrong, least privilege is a core component of zero trust, but it's not the only thing. And you know, if you look at the core premise, it's never trust, always verify. So you can apply it to, you know, I mentioned DevSecOps earlier. You can apply it to that. Imagine a developer, they're at their keyboard. Are you going to trust the code they're committing to the Git repository is secure? No, you know, you're going to do checks at that point. So then it's committed. Are you going to trust the images they're using for containers are secure? No, you're going to have a secure container repository. So that can fall into it as well. It's not just about, you know, privileges and having, you know, the least amount of minimally required permissions. You've got to expect every single step, which is why CISA have those five pillars, by the way, you know, from the user all the way to the data, every step and everything in between is verified every time. You know, a great example of this, multi-factor authentication. It might be seen, okay, checkbox, we've got that. But look at how that functions. We've seen cybersecurity incidents where this thing called MFA fatigue, where developers, I won't mention names, that they were spammed constantly until one of them, it just takes one, hits approve by mistake. And it depends on the implementation of multi-factor authentication, but it just takes that one to get into the organization.
Yeah.
So zero trust allows you to look at your technology as well and go, okay, could that happen? So I'm a big fan of it, but some vendors, not us, but some vendors do, I think, over market it and make out you just, you know, it's almost a joke in the cybersecurity industry is, oh, zero trust, we just need to put this appliance in and turn it on. Hey, we've got zero trust. Well, it doesn't work like that. It's also people and processes. And I think it's going to have to continually evolve. You know, all the stuff we talked about with AI and deep cloning of voices and video now. Yeah, it's certainly not ready for that yet, but I'd be interested to see how it evolves.
Yeah. Well, hey, thanks for being on. I think it's been a really, we could have probably chatted, and maybe, you know, we'll look at having some sort of side series of this particular podcast over the next 12 months, or even as you continue your journey here at Veeam, because I think it's just fascinating talking about the stuff. I think other people want to hear it as well, because you got tons of stories, tons of experience, and I think it's a really good introduction to the world of the field CISO at Veeam Software. So looking forward to working with you and your team, and you know, I think it's going to be a real advantage for Veeam in general to have people like yourself with your level of experience now working for the good guys. So, yeah. Hey, thanks.
Well, thank you for having me on.
That's okay. No worries. Until next time, we will catch you on the Sound of Tech to Come, a Veeam podcast. Thanks for being on the show, Ray.